Welcome to the New York Skies Astronomy Seminar for 2021, November 5, and ID John Pasmino. Our topic today is the lunar eclipse of 2021, November 19. That's 2 weeks from now, assuming you're playing this lesson on November 5th. You need the two files, audio and video. If you missed the video file, download it from www.nyskies.org, then click on Audio Video Files near the top of the home page. On this new page, AV Files page, near the bottom are links to this and many previous seminars. The files you're looking for are titled The Lunar Eclipse of 2021, November 5th. This page also explains how to join the New York Skies email group, where you can engage your astronomy with other members in and around New York, and also to give me answers to any quizzes and to make comments about the sessions. I'm very, very proud that the sessions have been a really runaway success and welcome adjunct to the astronomy of my audience, and many of your suggestions have been cranked into them. The quiz I left for you last time on stellar spectra, no one got the correct answer, although I had some ingenious suggestions. So please, even if you're not sure, but you just took a axe through the tree, and maybe the bark was too tough, the blade too dull, but you gave it a good effort. There are actually two main reasons. The fact that you don't get a complete blackout at an absorption line, and this is best shown in the densitometer tracings or profile, not so much in the photographic or classical spectrogram. You get the dip from the continuum, but the dip does not go all the way down. At the wavelength of that line, there's still illumination. The first reason is, at any moment, there are electrons in the excited states which did not yet return to their lower energy to emit their quanta. So there are more electrons at any instant excited than there are those returned and given up their quanta. The second major reason is that while the energy absorbed to make the line comes from radiation aiming toward us, but the emitted photon in the electrons returning to the home state can be emitted in any direction, not just toward us. So you'll get a net deficit of emitted radiation compared to that same amount of radiation which was absorbed. This is why when you look at the sun, you get an H-alpha filter. And if you scratch your head, hey, H-alpha is a dark line. How can you see anything in a dark line? Well, you're looking at the sun with the feeble radiation that does come to us for those two reasons. That is why when you do sun viewing through such a filter, you have to put a hood over your head shield your eyes, wait till you get literally dark adapted when you look in the eyepiece, and then you see faintly but distinctly the behavior on the sun's disk. Okay, you're standing on slide one, the title slide, which kind of summarizes the AV files page. And I have to thank many of you for pointing out some silly typos on this page, which I did correct. So don't worry about offending me or being ashamed if I make a boo-boo. Don't forget, in fact, in the next session for November 19th, well after the eclipse, we're talking about the Doppler effect, and I'll show you two colossal boo-boos that very good scientists made, and the errors were pointed out generations later. So at the bottom are reading supplements for you. They have the Aurora NY, because we are in an upswing in solar activity, not just on the trend line, but enhanced eruptions, which apparently began early or mid-October, and were continuing as I narrate this on November 4th, 2021. No aurora was seen in the New York skies region, except at the far, far northern end, say near Poughkeepsie, Dutchess, and Putnam counties. But they were seen farther north than that, and around the Great Lakes, and in Canada and Quebec. But you never know, so every time you're outdoors, please do scan the sky. Start in the north, sweep around, come back to the north. GANNYC is Globe at Night, New York City. The New York skies area does Globe at Night principally in the winter months using Orion as the target constellation, and Orion comes into the pre-midnight sky during November, and we have it all the way through April when it gets lost in the twilight. So the first round is about over, tomorrow being the last day, and I myself pursued Globe at Night, but many people miss it because the dates were announced kind of late. The next round begins on November 25 and runs through December 4. The dates in that GANNYC page may not be updated if you just run over there and look at it now. They will pretty quickly be, but now I told you those dates, and they're posted in the current issue of NYC Events. You go to the home page of our website and punch NYC Events among the jump words. The last one, well actually the third one, I did it out of order. The third one is ECL-FACT, Eclipse Facts, which gathers together in one file a lot of the boilerplate relating to eclipses. That got started about 5 or 6 years ago. We had several eclipses in New York City, and after doing two of them for announcements, I realized a hell of a lot of this stuff is kind of permanent, and I could put that in a single file for reference and just concentrate on the activity for the specific eclipse. But please read through that. It also gives several experiments that you can play with during a lunar eclipse. So please check that out. I'll point out a couple of them in the lesson, but there are more you can work on. Slide number 2 is a reminder. November 7, Sunday, a few days from now, we revert back to standard time. Set the clock back behind by 1 hour. That way the clocks will be back in sync with the sun and the stars. As I speak to you on November 4th, we're still in daylight time, but the lesson is about the eclipse on the 19th, and everything about it is in standard time. So just make sure Sunday you wake up and either immediately set the clock back or do so Saturday before when you turn yourself in to go to sleep. Okay? Slide number 3 is the continuing saga of Nova Cassiopeiae. You have there the history, the light curve, and you see it flared up several times. There was a oomph outburst late September, early October, and by end of October, it kind of leveled out a bit at around 8th magnitude. There's no telling what it will do in the future. I point this out not just for your routine checking up on the star during dark moon, like right now, but you have an extra opportunity during the lunar eclipse. The sky will darken sufficiently on the 19th to get in a look at the star, whereas normally at full moon it may be too dim. We have in slide 4 the finder chart for the star. It's the one I used on several previous exercises, and actually by now there are many versions of this in the web. And even Sky and Telescope put out an improved version. But this will get you started. On the lower left is the downtown triangle of Cassiopeia with Navi, going clockwise, Navi, Kaf, and Schieder. And if you go from Schieder to Kaf and go about the same distance beyond, make believe you're looking for M52, the open cluster, and the nova is about 2 degrees south of that. So just again, have this handy when you're out looking for the nova. We are just about near the end of the first round in New York sky for Globa Night. And I mentioned the dates a little earlier on in this lesson. We have an extra reading possible during the lunar eclipse. So the moon in very nearly full totality would be dark enough to count as a dark moon night, even though it would be early in the morning. Yet, as we'll see later on, Orion, the target constellation, is also in the same vicinity as the moon. So as long as you're watching the eclipse, you do a Globe at Night reading, and the file GANNYC on the title page explains how to do the work, and it has better reproductions of these magnitude charts. Okay, in slide 6 we have our hope for a brilliant comet. 2001 A1 is supposed to be a brilliant comet in end November through New Year's, and maybe going into January. We don't know that for sure, but as of end October, it has brightened pretty much on the anticipated predicted trend line to about 10th magnitude. Now, for many of us, that's still kind of faint, but it's rising rapidly, and if it stays on the trend, it'll be 8th magnitude at the end of November, which puts it in the range of almost any small telescope in the hands of a reasonably skillful observer. If you're familiar with finding deep sky objects of 8th magnitude or so, then you should find this comet. There's the orbital elements. If you want to plot your own path on the sky using a customized chart, when you open the field in your planetarium program for comet or new object or orbits or similar, those are the numbers they will ask you for. The peculiarity of this comet, if you look at the eccentricity, it's a shade over 1, meaning it's a hyperbola. And in the old days, I used to think the very rare instances were due to inaccuracies of observation. It really is a parabola, exactly 1. But no, we had enough examples since then that there are comets which appear to come from well beyond the solar system, or perhaps within the solar system, but somehow accelerated, maybe a gravity assist by Pluto, and therefore have accelerated into the hyperbolic category. So let's hope, although the next slide, 7, gives us a caution. The comet is racing eastward, roughly parallel to the ecliptic, and in November, December, it will be in the same part of the sky as the Sun itself, in Ophiuchus and Sagittarius. So this would be in twilight, actually strong twilight, which adds to the difficulty of finding it. So we have the antagonism of a comet near to the Sun linearly to jazz it up, as well as near the Sun angularly to smother it. So put on your, the wizard's hat for observing comets. Aurorae, or northern lights. Okay, I mentioned earlier about the uptick in solar activity and so on. This is a picture someone took in October, the previous outburst. And this view is what we might expect in the New York City vicinity, which includes all of Long Island, southern New England, northern New Jersey, the Catskills kind of place. A glow along the northern horizon, maybe with some vertical structure to it. And this one here is a green tint, which is characteristic of many aurora formations. Do not assume that a glow up there is an aurora. You really have to be familiar, intimately familiar, the way a riverboat on the Mississippi has to know every bend and twist and turn of that river. Play again the session on observing the northern lights. It's still on the web. Go back to the AV files page and suck those two files down and study them. But that is what we make. Of course, during the lunar eclipse, the moon is blanked out. You may scan the sky for aurorae. If it's there, you may see it. You would not normally see it during a full moon or other very large moon. All right, in slide 9, we actually begin eclipses. And this is an overview of why we get eclipses at all. the little squares centered on the Earth at 3-month intervals contains the orbit of the moon. The moon's orbit is a plane figure. It has extent in XY, but not in the third dimension, Z. And that orbit plane is tilted about 5 degrees to the plane of the Earth's orbit, represented by the circle centered on the sun. This is a grandstand view, so some of you newcomers, you learn that the planet orbits are ellipses, but this is not the ellipse we're referring to. This is a perspective ellipse. The kind of view, when you watch a football game, the yard lines seem to converge somewhere on the opposite side of the grandstands. They don't, they're parallel. Or at a baseball game, the playing pitch with the four bases looks like a diamond. It's actually a square. So the same thing. You're looking at a virtually circular orbit, sort of at an angle. Okay, the intercept of the moon's orbit and the Earth's orbit is called the line of nodes, and that's a straight line. Two planes intersect in a straight line, for those of you who took 12th year solid geometry. Well, I did because I was going into college for science or basket weaving, and I took the intermediate approach and went for engineering. So when that line of nodes lines up with the sun, which is the upper left and lower right view, then the shadow of the moon can fall on the Earth and make a solar eclipse, or the shadow of the Earth can fall on the moon to make a lunar eclipse. The lower left and upper right are the extremes where the tilt of the orbit forces the shadows to miss. So we do not get eclipses. We actually get eclipses in bunches. Like you may get a solar eclipse, then half a month later a lunar eclipse, and maybe a second half month a solar eclipse. So you get two or three at once, well, within a month period. Then there'd be a gap of several months, and then you get another round when the Earth is on the other side of the sun, two or three eclipses, then a gap, and so the eclipses come in seasons. They're actually spaced about 5.5 months apart for technical reasons. The orbit of the moon is not stable in space the way the planet orbits are. It wiggles and wobbles a bit, such that instead of every 6 months, as this diagram implies, it comes out to about 5.5 months. And if you were to tabulate on a graph years versus date, or say segment of a month, you would get an exquisitely pretty pattern, good enough to use for shower curtain motif. That's in slide 10. Yes, boss. Or if you really want to be dated, that's the cat's meow. Okay, if you look about two-thirds down on the left, you see the year 2021, and you have the months at the bottom. So if you read across, you'll see symbol for the moon, which is all blacked out, which means the total eclipse. And we see the sun symbol has a ring around it. That's the annual eclipse. The lunar eclipse was not visible from New York. The mid and west parts of the U.S. got good views of it. The annual eclipse, on the other hand, was visible as a partial eclipse in the east coast of New York, and the rest of the U.S. missed it. Continuing across, we have a partial eclipse. The moon symbol is only half filled in. That's the partial. That's our lesson for today. than a fully covered sun for a total eclipse 2 weeks later, and that is not visible here. It's in the other side of the Earth. It occurs during our nighttime. And you can see the flow of eclipses which back off roughly 10 days every year. It's all tied into the lunar year versus the solar year, the metonic cycle, the 19-year cycle, and so on and so forth. But that's why you get eclipses typically in two bunches each year. In the intervening months, you get nothing. Okay, we get a lunar eclipse. The sun casts a shadow of the Earth. The Earth is opaque, it's made of rock, out as a long, thin cone, and the moon will pass through. Here, we're looking down from the north. The North Pole is in the middle of the Earth, and the moon circulates counterclockwise. So coming around from the bottom of the page, it enters what we call the penumbra, from the Latin word meaning almost umbra, the Spanish word pen meaning almost, and then it moves into the darker part, the umbra, where it is covered up, and then after the eclipse it moves back into the other side of the penumbra, and then off the picture above, it's in the clear. Now, the normal diagrams of these, you have to know this, please. Even newcomers can tell you. The ones who don't know and treat these diagrams as absolute gospel, as part of the curriculum, the CRT stuff, show the Earth, Sun, and Moon on one page, the Sun being twice the size of the Earth, and the Moon being half the size of the Earth, and you have crisscrossing lines this way and that way, and the umbra is very steep, almost like a custard cone, and the penumbra flares out like peacock feathers, and that is grossly out of scale both by sizes and by distances. I'll give you an idea. Your computer screen, you may have a half meter wide computer screen. It's kind of standard. They're cheap enough, you know. The thing I'm looking at to narrate this and explain the slides is half a meter across and costing $100. So imagine that on your screen you want the model, the Earth, Moon, a Sun for an eclipse. And the Earth on your screen is 1 cent diameter. Would the Moon, to the same scale, fit on that screen? It would if you put the Earth at one side of the screen and the Moon would be near the other side, 30 cents away. And it would be about 3 millimeters diameter. What about the Sun? The Sun would be about a meter in diameter, and it would stand roughly 100 meters away. So even though I took a generously small size for the Earth, you could not in scale put the entire mechanics of a eclipse on a screen or a sheet of paper. There is an interesting scenario where if you take a meter stick and craft, or arts and craft balls or decorative balls of the proper size, or you can shave them down to the right size and tack them to the ends of the meter stick and take this out in sunlight, you can, by turning the stick one way or the other, mimic more or less properly a solar eclipse and then a lunar eclipse. Some of our audience did that, and then they go out and use it at public showings. They use a street light that's down the block, so it's kind of a small angular size. But that is your lunar eclipse. Now, you see, the moon is not blacked out completely. There's illumination within the umbra. The Earth is surrounded by atmosphere, which has a lensing effect. I mean, it's on a curved surface. It also absorbs or diffracts and scatters the shorter wavelengths. That's what makes our sky blue. It's blue because the blue end of the spectrum of the sun is thrown all over the place. The yellow to red end gets through. That's because of the particles of the air molecules and the diffraction patterns against them, stuff like that. So the longer waves get through, and they're also refracted into the umbra, so you do get some illumination, which is predominantly yellow, orange, reddish. So when the moon is in the umbra, it would typically turn into or have a red cape or hood, the umbra, passing over it. In slide 12, we see that the idea of umbra, penumbra, is not limited to astronomy. Here someone took a picture of the shadow. You know what the building is. You know from the silhouette, don't you? Anyone here doesn't know? Good. Everyone knows. So that's the Empire State Building. That's for those of us who are not in our audience, okay? And it has a dark inner part, but notice that the edges are fuzzy. If you're standing in the dark area and look up at the sun, you won't see it. The building's blocking it. If you're near the edge, which has some illumination, that's why it's not fully dark, the building will be cutting across the disk of the sun. The sun will be peeping out from behind the building, and therefore you're getting sunlight. Not full sunlight, so that's why it's almost a shadow. Pen, or penna in Latin, umbra, which is the Latin word for shade or shadow. I remember when I was in Bogota, Colombia, and I wanted to see a show in their arena, and at the ticket window, the clerk asked me, "The sales in Tejerca para el Sol or La Umbra? Do you want to sit on the sunny side with the sun in your face, or do you want to sit in the shaded side? Umbra, por favor." This way, the sun shines onto the field, not on me. The edge, therefore, is the penumbra. Now, of course, if you're too far to the left or right and look up at the sun, you see the sun in the sky, and the Empire State Building is off to one side. But look at the needle. It's actually a pretty thick structural member that used to support broadcast antennae. It's the mast, as you call it. There's no umbra. It's the entire shadow is blurry, because if you were standing down there looking at it, the mast is too narrow to cover the sun. So even though it's centered, the sun shows on both sides, filling the ground with partial light, and that's why you get a penumbra with no umbra. Broadly speaking, there are three kinds or types of lunar eclipse, depending on the flight path of the moon through the shadow. The figure on the left shows the moon passing through the penumbra, and it misses the umbra. Now, you don't see the umbra penumbra like the bullseye target you see here, because with the moon out of the way, there's nothing for the shadow to throw onto. Just like you would not see the Empire State Building shadow if you didn't have all those short, stubby 30, 40, 50 story buildings for it to land on. We can calculate the size of the shadow from the geometry, the size and distances of the Earth, Moon, and Sun, and that is what the diameter, linear diameter, would be at the distance of the Moon. So if the Moon misses the umbra, goes to the penumbra, you probably would not notice any dimming of the Moon, because the Sun is so brilliant that even if a very large fraction is covered, there's enough to cause ordinary daylight. Now, if you've watched eclipses of the Sun, the ground to the eye is pretty much normal brilliance until the last 10 or so minutes of partial phase before totality. Then you notice, hey, wait a minute, what happened to the sunlight? There's the Sun, but no, it's as if I were wearing weak sunglasses or something. So you would not notice a penumbra eclipse normally, and most of us don't even bother watching out for them. We may know that a certain full moon is in a penumbral eclipse. We may glance at it, it looks like a perfectly normal full moon. The middle picture is partial, where the moon goes into the umbra, but not fully. There's a part of the moon, the lower part in this picture, which overhangs the penumbra and remains in full sunlight. The sky does not darken fully. That is the eclipse that we will see, which will be, as we'll get into details, technically partial, but damn close to being total, and with some funny atmospherics around the Earth, could actually look total. But the normal garden variety partial eclipse, there's a substantial part of the moon remains exposed. The picture on the right, the moon plows directly into the umbra, is covered by it until it comes out on the other side. But in these scenes, the moon passes right to left and north is up. The eclipse in May, this past May, was total, which we never saw. The one in May 2022, also total, we will see it over all of the United States. And this one in November is a cliffhanger total. Well, it's a partial. But those are the three grand categories of lunar eclipse. Some of us, especially the older of us, like to, well, we had no choice in the old days, do our own computations and graphically lay out the path of the moon through the umbra. We, you know, drawing material, you know, triangles and parallels and fine pointed pencils and a T-square, and using some of the raw data, such as is issued in the fact sheets put out by NASA. This is the top half of that sheet, and the facts and figures for the Sun on the left and for the Moon on the right are ingredients, plus some other parts of astronomy you better know, will allow you to lay out to scale the flight of the Moon through the eclipse, the different stages. And if you slide a cutout of the moon against a time scale, which you also lay out, you can get the times of the contacts, when the moon enters and leaves the umbra and penumbra. So I put that out if you want to fool around with this for yourself. I do the same in slide 15, which gives the lower half. If you're worried why the diagram is cut off, I have a better diagram a little farther on. You don't need that one. Yeah, 15. It's the lower half of that fact sheet. It gives you some more parameters to play with on the top left and top right. The top right is kind of interesting. U1, P for Papa 1, MIDI clips, U4, and Papa 4. P is penumbra, U is umbra. Those are the contacts entering the penumbra, entering the umbra, middle of the eclipse, leaving the umbra, and leaving the penumbra. Now, what happened to contact 2 and 3? Well, there are none. It's a partial eclipse. The umbra never completely covers the moon. So, second contact would be the umbra on the moon, and then just fully covers. That's contact, second contact, or U2. And then after a while, when the umbra starts to leave the moon and exposes a bit of it at the trailing side, that would be U3, or third contact. So since there are no such features in a partial eclipse, you just have entering the umbra misses full coverage, and you do leave. All times are universal time because this chart is distributed worldwide. By the way, it's a negative cut. I do that because I've had complaints not only at the live seminars but also at other lectures that a white background with lettering on is, for many of us, especially older of us, a little tough to read. We have an eye defect, an aging, whatever, where the line work for the lettering is too thin and it kind of disappears. Or it just becomes too glary, especially after seeing a couple of dark pictures, like astronomical pictures, have dark backgrounds. Then the guy puts up a slide with some equations, and boom, it's like shining a flashlight on you while you're doing media watching. So I do the negatives. I do that because I listen to what you tell me. Okay, this slide shows the parts of the world where the eclipse is visible. The white area on the bottom in the southern hemisphere and around the South Pole, no eclipse. All of the western hemisphere, North and South America, sees the eclipse. Europe and Africa miss it, but Eastern Asia, China, the East Indies, Australia, Japan, they see it. I told you I had a much better picture showing the flight path. That's in slide 16. Okay, this shows the moon path. It also shows a white line slanting from left, dipping down to the right. That's the ecliptic. The X in the middle is the center line from the sun through the earth to the center of the umbra. You notice that the moon's path slants upward from a little ways away, by half a degree away, gauging by the angular size of the moon, and is heading toward the ecliptic, which it will cross somewhere off the left side of the picture. So the moon doesn't have to be at exactly the intercept of her orbit and the Earth's orbit, but can be distant a little ways, and that can be calculated. This being about the farthest away that the moon can be to have a total eclipse. And then we have the times of what the different stages in universal time. So for Eastern Standard Time, you subtract 5 hours. The middle scene with the moon all in the umbra, if you look closely, there's a little overhang of the moon outside the umbra. And that would be the moon which should be in sunlight. However, it happens at eclipses, not all the time, but we generally anticipate, because of some atmospherics going on, which I don't think we understand that well, the optical size of the umbra is bloomed out, maybe about 1% of its diameter. And that would be enough to nudge the umbra over the exposed edge of the moon and make the eclipse optically total, although geometrically it is partial. So you have there, starting from the lower right, where the moon is moving to the right, north is up, enters the penumbra and it makes the note unobservable. That's just a geometrical effect. Think of the Empire State Building. You're on the ground and you see the sun. If you walk such that you're trying to hide the sun behind the building, instantly the disk of the sun touches, is tangent to the edge of the building. That spot on the ground is the outer edge of the building's penumbra. And if you keep walking, the sun is hidden more and more, and instantly the last bit of sun is covered. That is the edge of the umbra, or the inner edge of the penumbra. And if you keep walking, you're in the umbra, and you have the reverse stages if you keep going down the block and let the sun come out from behind. So that's what you have here. So then you have the second picture, or the scene. The moon is touching the umbra, which is first contact, and then it proceeds into the umbra, and then you have the middle of the eclipse, and then the fourth picture shows the moon finally quitting the umbra. That's fourth contact. And then the last, on the far left, the moon leaves the penumbra. And you have the times there and some text in the decorating the scene. It's good for anywhere where the eclipse is visible, and you have to make the conversion to your local time, whether it's a zone time or some country, you just have to use the actual longitude of your site. In 17, I give you a timetable for the eclipse, and there are a couple of things to look out for here. I started with when the moon crosses the local meridian, which in New York's longitude occurs a little before local midnight in November 18. And then the next entry, which is 0 hours, is local midnight when the date becomes November 19, and the whole rest of the eclipse through sunrise and moonset are in the 19th. In the Pacific Ocean, or let's say starting at the Nevada-China border in the western United States, the eclipse will begin in local time before midnight, that is, late night of the 18th, and then the eclipse rolls through midnight into the 19th. So please bear in mind, as a general rule, nighttime events, you better be careful how you specify the time and double check the date. You could be an hour, a day early or a day late. And there's a horrible story about a eclipse group that arrived on the scene. I forget the actual eclipse, but it was a ground-based eclipse. So if you observed from the ground in a certain town, a group, we saw the eclipse, and we came back to our hotel. Another group came in the evening, we were going to check in, and we just assumed that they came from some place to see the eclipse, and now they returned to this hotel to spend the night. Well, after they heard that we saw the eclipse and all that, they realized they goofed on the date, and they thought they were arriving the night before, but they arrived the night after. Another entry in here, you see Foist Penumbra, and then Last Penumbra. And I think the next couple of slides will explain that a little better. But of interest in the middle there, I have column for the altitude and azimuth of the moon. And you will need that to reconnoiter observing sites. For the city, and actually generally at our longitude, the moon's will be a very low altitude toward the end of the eclipse. So if you are gunning to see the entire eclipse, first to fourth contacts, then use these as azimuths to check for obstructions or interferences. Observing site, perfectly viewable and adequate for other kinds of stargazing, may zap you because there's a tree or something in the west, which didn't bother you before, but it may cover the moon in the latter stages of the eclipse. Okay, a picture focusing on tracking the umbra, or master tracking the sun. This is from a previous, some other eclipse, but it very closely matches the geometry of our eclipse in a couple of weeks. No, I did not hop on my time machine, zoom away 2 weeks into the future, get these pictures, and then come back here to show them to you. No, somebody else took these from an eclipse. It might even be 19 years ago. I forget. Essentially what you're doing is you have, say, piggyback or a separate equatorial camera with a motor drive and photograph the moon when it's roughly halfway in near mid-eclipse and somewhat halfway coming out. And that is geometrically what we should see in the middle picture with a blip of moon showing. So this gives you some idea what to expect. I mentioned the penumbra, which you normally cannot see, but this photographer here, on some previous eclipse, it was actually a penumbral eclipse. The umbra never got onto the moon, yet we can use this as a guide to what we could expect for our eclipse. First off, if you sit back, he has the photographic data in the lower right corner. If you sit back a bit, you'll see that the moon on the left is notably brighter per square millimeter or centimeter of screen is more luminous than the moon on the right. So the moon on the right is fully in the penumbra, which is, because it gets only partial sunlight, darker than the uneclipsed moon. But unless you have the fully exposed moon side by side for comparison, you just would not notice it. It's like with supermoon. You go out because the newspaper tells you, oh, the moon is going to be bigger than ever since a month ago. Tonight. So you go out and you see this great big moon. like a giant that beats a pie. But how do you know if it's any bigger annually than a full moon at any other time around the moon's orbit? You don't, because you don't normally do this. Now, you can verify this by taking a telephoto picture of that moon, and then wait a couple of months, take a picture with the same camera lens of the full moon, which will then be away from the perigee, and you compare the two pictures, which you can do digitally, and you'll see the difference in the sizes. But just by trying to remember, you won't do that. Same thing. I saw the full moon last month, that's how bright it was, but I'll have utterly no recollection or means to compare what it looks like now in eclipse. But the important thing besides that is the penumbra bordering the umbra can be dark enough to show as a smoky or cloudy shading on the part of the moon next to the umbra. So let us pretend this is our eclipse and the umbra is coming down on the right-hand picture from the upper right. Then a few minutes before the contact point, first contact of the moon is about to enter the umbra, you may see this smoky brownish orangey hue on the moon, which helps you to fix the point on the moon where the umbra will come on, and also is a way to cue you to, hey, get ready if you're doing some kind of experiment or photography to make sure everything is in order, because within a few minutes the umbra will come on. So in the timetable, a couple of slides back, I allowed 15 minutes before first contact and after last contact for the shading of the penumbra, which sometimes is very noticeable, and some people may even confuse it with the umbra, and other times it just isn't there. That's a feature to look for. Okay, slide 20 is like a general wide field view looking west near fourth contact. So the eclipse is run through and it shows the area of the sky. I put some landmark stars on the right center. You have Betelgeuse and Rigel, and the belt of Orion about halfway in between. So that's Orion. And it would be great if during the eclipse, maximum eclipse, you do a globe at night assessment. Near the top we have Capella and Elnath, which are stars characterizing Auriga. In the upper left we have Procyon. And at the bottom, we have a triangular formation of Hyades, Pleiades, and Moon. And then on the right center, we have Murfrak and Algol for Perseus, and Cassiopeia would be off the left side, I'm sorry, off the right side near the top of the picture. So that's about where you find the nova. If you do any other kind of variable work and there are stars in the winter, and if you look south and east in the spring skies, which you normally could not see because of the bright moon, this would be a good opportunity to try and get a data point for some of those stars. Here's what I told you before about checking out your observing site. This location, perhaps unanticipated, has a tree which will probably cut off the moon and you will lose fourth contact. So please do verify that your viewing site will cover the entire eclipse. Now, this is really for the Eastern time zone, where the eclipse occurs all hours through dawn. Central and farther west in the U.S., the moon will be higher up. You can imagine in Chicago, for instance, or let's say Indianapolis, that was Chicago, Indianapolis, the sky will rotate upper left by 15 degrees to match the view in Central Standard Time, and then farther west will just be higher up in the sky. So the critical concern for horizon obstructions is for us in the east. A close-up, such as with a my portrait lens, let's say, is in slide 21. We have up in the upper left, we have Aldebaran and the Hyades. And then in the right center, we have the Pleiades. And then at the bottom, we have the eclipsed moon with the umbra coming onto it. And these will make a very nice picture. So even though it is a partial eclipse, and even though we possibly will not get the blooming of the umbra, so it will be a Rheal-McCoy partial eclipse, you can get a photogenic scene like this. We leave the Earth and go to the Moon in slide 22. Some planetarium programs and pretty much a solar system simulators allow you to explore the sky by standing on another planet or the moon. So I did that, and not this particular picture, I borrowed it. But you can go to the moon and set the date and time for the lunar eclipse. And what will happen is you see the Earth crossing in front of the sun to make a solar eclipse. And that's the corona of the sun gushing out from behind the moon. And because there is no atmosphere on the moon, the sky does not darken any more than it usually is. So a lot of the area atmospheric effects will be lost. What will happen is the temperature on the surface of the moon, which in full sunlight approaches 100 C, will plummet in a few minutes down to like minus 80 to minus 100 C, because the ground, being dusty and porous and whatever, it cannot retain heat, and it'll just whoosh out into space. Which, by the way, is an experiment you could try if you have, thermometric equipment of some sort. You could photograph spots on the moon in and out of the umbra and see how you can get the graph of the temperature changes. So that's what happens on the moon. So if you were given a demo for a club meeting or whatever, you could have two computers, one running the eclipse and perhaps with the same software running the scene from the moon. You put the screen side by side or use two projectors on the wall, and this way the members can intercompare stages of the eclipse as we see it to what the man on the moon will see. Slide 23 shows that the umbra in an eclipse can be of a wide range of darkness or lightness. And here we have four examples of umbrae in various previous eclipses. The lower left shows what was the brightest umbra among pictures I examined, and in this instance the moon would probably be bright enough still to cast shadows on the ground and light your way as you go about. On the right, if you look closely, there's an umbra there. The moon is almost gone, and I've seen a couple eclipses where the moon disappeared and I had trouble seeing it by eye and I had to fish around for it with binoculars. The upper two give lesser extreme darkness on the left and brighter ones on the right. The one on the right being kind of your more usual moon. There's another interesting feature. I think the next slide shows better of what happens in a eclipse where the umbra is covered the moon, or in our case, maybe just barely so. But be prepared for an umbra of brightness range like you see in this picture. Okay, there are only a couple more, 27 altogether for this session. Here, on slide 24, is an interesting effect. I used to think it was an optical illusion in the eye, but it's been photographed a few times. The edge of the umbra sometimes looks blue. That's blue. I don't know what the cause is, but it has to do with maybe the air is so clear around the edge of the Earth that some blue rays get in. And blue rays are not quite, they refract not quite as much, so you can get that feeling. So it could be the effect of a very crude prism, in the spectrum effect. You don't always see it. Usually the blue is reflected, refracted away. But if you sit back a bit, that's not a flat disk the way we normally see a full moon, but it has a ball shape. It's almost, you are looking at a round sphere or globe. Of course, you really are. But normally, full moons or very large moon looks like a cutout of cardboard. You pasted it on the celestial sphere. And during an eclipse, if the umbra is not overly bright or overly dark, you get the impression that the moon is a round, spherical, three-dimensional body. It shows nicely here, in addition to the blue edge. If you move on to slide 25 is a table of lunar eclipses seen in New York from 2000 to 2040. Actually, the last entry for 2037. There were no more eclipses from the city until 2040. So some of these you may remember, certainly if you're a millennial. All of these eclipses occurred in your lifetime, and for us elder folk, the future ones we enjoyed during our golden years. All right, you have the date. It's the day, month, year, and universal time. We then have the, we say the zenith. Our zenith time latitude. That's the lat longitude where the eclipse is in the zenith at mid-eclipse, and the local time when that occurs. It's a gives you an idea about where on the world elsewhere you can see the eclipse besides here in the United States. Otherwise, you can leave it alone. The next column, magnitude, it's a figure of merit telling you the kind of eclipse, which is kind of redundant because the next column gives you the type, and how that's calculated is explained in that article, ECL.FACT, Eclipse Fact. In general, an eclipse less than one, as a decimal, 0 point, is partial. and one or greater is total. But then there's a figure for penumbral eclipses, which I do not give here. I took out all the penumbral eclipses, I omit completely. The last columns there gives you the time of mid-eclipse in New York, presuming that you see the eclipse at least through or up to or since mid-eclipse. On the occasions when we don't, because the moon rose after mid-eclipse or sets before mid-eclipse, the last columns give the state of the moon at rising or at setting, the hour of moon rise or moon setting, giving 0 degrees altitude, the azimuth, the amount of coverage, and then the kind of eclipse. Where it's, that is, it may be, it's partial for us, even though someplace else it may be total. That can happen. So keep that handy, snap that picture, and keep that with your observing things to do in the years to come. You can see the eclipse in May of 2022 is a very nice total, and it's visible completely, at least through, yeah, well, actually, if you look at the hour, the moon is way up in the sky, so we'll see the whole eclipse. You don't have to have a lunar eclipse to see the shadow of the Earth. Some of us see the shadow if we're on an airplane flight which crosses sunset or sunrise as seen from the plane. Now you're 9 or 10 kilometers up, so just before the sun rises or just after the sun sets as seen from the plane, we may look out our window at right angles to the direction of the sun, and you will see a wedge of sky that's dark against the ground, and the rest of the sky above is lighted. So the wedge or the border is the edge of the Earth's shadow, because the sun is not high enough above the local horizon down there to make it full daylight. But without an airline trip, if you look over level ground for indefinite distance, like here the ocean front, open plains, farmlands, or maybe an elevation where you're above the local relief, then just before sunrise and immediately after sunset, we would see the shadow of the Earth, like we see here. That band is distinctly darker under than above. Now that this is so, I've always seen it best at sunset. For some reason, I miss frequently the sunrise apparitions. It's just me, my own peculiarity. But the sunset ones, I can kind of depend on. You do need some light moisture or thin haze in the sky. If you have a brilliantly clear sky, then there's nothing to scatter the light and make the shadow. So, but this has some mist in the sky or whatever, and you get the shadow effect. Now, as the sun is setting, that rises upward, and the border becomes more distinct. And by the time you get to, you know, actual twilight, the border is obliterated because the shadow above you rose above you well into the upper stratosphere, which is where all the obscure material is anyway. And so you're engulfed in the shadow, and then soon will be nighttime. But that's how you can see the Earth's shadow without an eclipse. La fin de lune. End of the show. This shows how you can see eclipses of the moon. not our moon. I didn't say only our moon. They be the moons of Jupiter. And when we had the lesson on observing Jupiter, we had this slide. You probably remember it from that lesson. And in the lower left is the shadow of Jupiter at the distance away for that particular satellite. And you had a sample of phenomena or events regarding the moons of Jupiter, and among them were the moon going into eclipse or coming out of eclipse. And that's an interesting sight. The moon in this instance passing from upper right of the shadow, between the shadow and Jupiter, goes into eclipse. It's utterly invisible. And then the next event for that satellite, it emerges or egress from the eclipse at the lower left of the shadow. The shadow of the moon is utterly black. There's no illumination because the clouds, the atmosphere, is opaque and does not let light shine through. It's all absorbed within the body of the planet. But that is how you can see eclipses many times a month. And you can almost guarantee it because except for Callisto, which can miss the shadow because the farthest out and the shadow is smallest, the other three moons will always go into eclipse because their orbits are almost coincident with the ecliptic, unlike the Earth's moon, which has that 5-degree tilt. So it gets eclipses of the moon every one of its own local months, which are from several days to 2 weeks. And also, if you're lucky, you can see the solar eclipses where the shadow of the moon falls onto the globe of the planet. But that is how you can see eclipses of, quote, moon, quote, other than our own moon, and almost routinely throughout an Earth-based month. That finishes off our lesson, and I leave you with a quiz, and I'll give you some clues. If you go back to slide 11, we have the Earth, the moon is in the umbra, and all that. The question for you is, what fraction of the Earth's circumference or longitude will see some part of a lunar eclipse? Now, it's pretty obvious from this snapshot that the entire half of the Earth facing the moon will see, that's the nighttime side, will see the eclipse. But the Earth rotates and the eclipse lasts several hours. So I'll let you use a nominal length of eclipse of 4 hours. That's extreme, center over center, the moon moving slowest at apogee, and therefore its angle is smaller, and first contact through fourth contact is 4 hours. We'll round it off. Then accounting for the Earth's rotation and letting at least some eclipse be visible. So the moon may rise at a location just before fourth contact, or the moon may set just after first contact. So what wedge angle in longitude or degrees or hours could possibly see a lunar eclipse? You may actually want to make a little model out of cardboard and rotate them and push the moon along and all this kind of silly thing. It'll be a lot of fun. Or you have a globe, an old school globe, and you have a flashlight and a ball, and you rotate the Earth and play around that way. It may be a little team effort at a club meeting, like a workshop exercise. Try it. So until then, make sure you're back on standard time and pray for clear skies.